This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Friday, March the 22nd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Before we start, I want to tell you that Inside Politics is taken to the road in a couple of weeks. We are planning a number of live events throughout the year, and I'm delighted to say that the first of these is going to be in Belfast on Wednesday, April the 10th, in front of a live audience at the Mac on Exchange Street West, where I will be joined by our political editor, Pat Leahy, Northern editor, Freya McClements, and Lisa Clare Whitten, who has a new book on Northern Irish politics coming out. The show kicks off at 6:30 p.m. and we would love to see you there and to hear your points and questions. To buy your tickets, just go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com. Now, I mentioned Pat Leahy, and he's here in the flesh, but he's not. He's here incorporeally from Brussels, where he's been observing Leo Varadkar's last EU summit as Taoiseach. Political correspondent Harry McGee is also here in the room. He was listening earlier to the man who we now know will be taking over Varadkar as Taoiseach on April the 9th. Hello to you both.
Hi, Hugh.
Bonjour, Hugh.
Pat, I'm tempted by that hoariest of old clichés about a week being a long time in politics. It finally seems applicable. Maybe 24 hours being a long time in politics.
Yeah, certainly wasn't the week that we were expecting. We were talking about a nice quiet week this week, you know, with the Dáil back for a couple of days before the two-week Easter break. That was all turned upside down on Wednesday morning. You know, I suppose listeners will be familiar with the... We're familiar with the course of events now. Rumours start to fly around early in the morning. Major resignation coming from government, even until I think shortly before Leo Varadkar came out and made his statement, people were speculating about other names. They didn't actually believe it was going to be Leo Varadkar, because this is a thing that Taoiseachs and prime ministers rarely do. They rarely just come out and resign for no ostensible reason other than they think, you know, it's time for someone else to do the job. Normally, that's a decision that is made for them by others. Other people decide that someone else should do the job. Not on this occasion.
Harry, it is customary on these occasions, it might sound a bit tasteless, but to have a quick obituary of the politician who is leaving the stage. And I know from looking at our schedules, particularly for tomorrow's weekend edition of the Irish Times, that there'll be more than one of those. It's a bit of a snap reaction, but what would be your overall picture of the career of Leo Varadkar at the top of Irish politics?
Yeah, no, I did a profile of him on Wednesday, I think, when he resigned. And the things that struck me when I was writing it is that he is a person who came into Fine Gael not because of any family connections or because of any network connections. It was from an ideological perspective completely. He believed in the Fine Gael product. When he went in, he was a Christian Democrat. He's probably now a Social Democrat, but he's always been a huge believer in the free market. He has believed in enterprise. He would be fiscally quite conservative, and that's something that has remained with him throughout his career. Where he has pivoted has been in relation to social questions. He would have been very conservative when he first entered politics.
Was he? Would he be in questions of what? Reproductive rights, things like that?
All of those. He would have been opposed to them all. And then he went through an evolution in relation to those and changed. He would have been very close, for example, to Lucinda Creighton when they both went in. And I think they began to divert in terms of their views, and that became most apparent when she left the party in 2014 over proposed legislation in relation to abortion. Of course, he himself, I think some of it was because of his own personal experience. He came out as a gay man in 2015. I mean, he had been out already, but he came out publicly on the Marion Finucane show in 2015. And I think that was telling in relation to his own evolution in terms of his social worldview. So that was one part of it. I think from the beginning, what marked him out as a politician is that he was a thinker. He was a person who had very strong views. He was always very good at articulating those views. He seemed to have a very quick grasp of the issues and why the issues were important, and was able to frame them in such a way that made him seem far more strategic than a lot of his colleagues. So he was a great communicator on a macro level or on a national level. But when it came down to the personal level, he was socially very awkward. He's probably a little bit less awkward now than he was when he began as a politician, Hugh, but he's not a person for small talk. He's not a tactile politician in the way we expect our Irish politicians to be. And he was unusual in that respect. So if we look at kind of leaders like Enda Kenny and Bertie Ahern, who were kind of hail fellow well met, loved to press the flesh, loved the kind of the social part of it, that was never Varadkar's forte. He was never good at that. But he was good at looking at issues, at finding what was the kernel of that issue, what was important. And then he was, when he came up with solutions, he was very good at articulating what that solution might be. And we could see that, for example, during his best times as a politician, in the way that he dealt with Brexit, for example, the Brexit negotiations, and how he marshalled the initial response of Ireland to the COVID epidemic in 2020.
And yes, Pat, I would agree with Harry that his two most successful political events really were Brexit and COVID. And those were challenges that were thrown into his path that he didn't necessarily look for. I suppose the question is, was the Varadkar proposition, which became clear as he rose through the ranks of Fine Gael, which what propelled him into the leadership, what exactly was that proposition? And did he deliver on it in the end, either for his party or indeed to the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of the conundrum about Varadkarism, to the extent that such a thing exists. And I think its truest presentation was probably during the Fine Gael leadership election in 2017 between himself and Simon Coveney, when there was a genuine debate between, Coveney representing the just society traditions of Fine Gael and Varadkar, which I suppose the social democratic side of Fine Gael, and Varadkar talking about the need for the party to look after what he called the people who get up early in the morning, which of course could mean anybody, but I think we all know what he meant, and the country knew what he meant, and certainly the voters in that election, the Fine Gael organisation, they knew what he meant. The difficulty, I suppose, in applying that sort of essentially centre-right political philosophy in Ireland is that the centre of gravity politically, I think, had moved to the left in Ireland. And while Varadkar talked centre-right, for a substantial amount of time, and certainly that was true to his own political instincts for a long time back. I remember, the former Labour leader Eamon Gilmore, talking about how that the Varadkar crop of young Fine Gaelers that had come in between local elections in 2004 and the general election in 2007, he was horrified at them. He thought they were Tories, I remember him telling me on one occasion. And they certainly, that was where Varadkar came from. The difficulty is applying that in government in Ireland. If you look at the budgets, the expansionary budgets that Varadkar's government oversaw, is that they were overwhelmingly devoted. His spare cash was overwhelmingly devoted to the expansion of the public sector, the expansion of the state investment in public services, all of things which are classic, classic pillars of social democracy. And so I think that there was, in some respects, a sort of a contradiction there between Varadkar's kind of natural, inherent political appeal and his own instincts and the realities of governing in Ireland. Brendan Howland once said publicly that Labour's greatest achievement in power between 2011 and 2016 was making a social democrat of Leo Varadkar. But I think that, government in Ireland, because of where the country is politically, I think maybe makes a sort of a social democrat of everybody who participates in it. And I think that is one of the reasons why, despite, those successes that Varadkar had, particularly with in relation to Brexit, and let's not forget the extent of that challenge and the extent of his success at it, which was to achieve the two vital national interests that he, I think, correctly identified. One, to maintain Ireland's central role in the EU single market, and secondly, to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland. And he achieved those. But when it came to the 2020 general election, I think that those contradictions between his political instincts and his kind of natural political inclinations and the realities of governing in Ireland, I think left us with a sort of, you know, a pitch to voters, which maybe it's a bit harsh to call it incoherent, but it certainly was unsuccessful. And we saw that in the poor performance that Fine Gael had in 2020. And I think that politically, Varadkar and Fine Gael never really recovered from that election.
Which brings us to the question now, Harry, of whether Fine Gael, I suppose, is really the question. Varadkar has left. We'll talk a little bit about Simon Harris in a moment. But the actual state of Fine Gael, like all the larger Irish parties, certainly the big three that we have at the moment, it's a coalition. And we kind of know the historical lineaments of what the coalition was with Fine Gael. It's sort of the Garrett Fitzgerald Just Society wing, which was referred to, which is more social democratic as well as being socially liberal, and a more fiscally conservative and perhaps socially conservative, perhaps slightly more rurally based wing as well. And a lot of the criticism we've seen, interestingly, over the last 2 weeks or so, whether it's right or it's wrong, it's definitely out there, and from some older members of the party like Charlie Flanagan, for example, is that it's gone too far towards the Just Society social progress line, and it's left the other very important wing behind.
Yeah, when we talk about Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, we always talk about kind of homogenous parties, but they're not homogenous parties, never have been. There's been the urban-rural divide. There's always been that tension between more conservative elements and more progressive elements within each of the parties, probably more marked in Fine Gael. But that's happened in Fianna Fáil more so in recent times under Micheál Martin, who is quite a liberal leader, probably the most liberal leader that Fianna Fáil have had when you look at it from the social perspective. But there are elements within the party who are still, you know, rural and conservative. I think magazines unkindly called them backwards men in the past. It's not a fair description at all, but there is that tension, and that tension continues until today. And we can actually see it in action at present through the filter of the debate over immigration and housing those seeking international protection, housing Ukrainians, where the protests have been throughout the state. We have seen Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TDs coming out to support the protests and to question the government's own policies in relation to immigration. We've also seen that manifest itself in Sinn Féin. And one of the things that's been said consistently about Sinn Féin over the past decade is that it there was an easy option for it to pursue in relation to becoming a populist party in quote marks, and that would have been to pander to a small but significant anti-immigrant sentiment that was evident in some communities. It didn't go down that road, and the party has to be commended for that. But we have seen that the sentiment in relation to immigrants has hardened a lot in the past years, and it's evident in our snap polls that we publish every month. And we see that not only Sinn Féin, but also Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have begun to triangulate a little bit in terms of hardening their own positions in relation to immigration.
Is there a possibility, Harry, that the model of the big catch-all party, that's a very broad church, goes back to the old two-party hegemony days, where that definitely described Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and the broad coalition of the electorate that each of them appealed to. And it's sort of been transported into what we now have as a kind of a big three. But maybe it's not sustainable in the long term. Maybe we're in a mode of transition towards something different again.
That's why the fortunes of the two big parties have diminished, because the era of the catch-all party has come to a close. Fianna Fáil, which was a kind of an aspirational party, you know, it appealed to all those who wanted to aspire to a better life. That related to a particular era in a more complicated and more urban society, where all the certainties that, you know, that lay behind Fianna Fáil in terms of, you know, a very Catholic country, a very rural country, a very agrarian country, a socially conservative country, all of those old precepts have gone now, and the party has struggled to find its voice. Funny enough, Pat was talking about Fine Gael and the incoherence of its message in the run-up to 2020. The same could be argued about Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil has found it difficult to land itself in modern society. You know, what is Fianna Fáil? Who does it stand for? What does it stand for? I think it has had huge difficulty in articulating where it is. The likes of Eamon O'Keefe has argued that it should become a niche party, a socially conservative niche party that appeals to a more rural demographic. Others in the party disagree with that, and so others are persevering with this kind of catch-all nature. But I would argue that catch-all nature just doesn't have any traction in the society that we have today. So going back to Fine Gael, I think Fine Gael, I just feel in the last year or two it has been a little bit more focused in terms of where it stands. But ironically, it is facing more difficulties than Fianna Fáil in electoral terms. When you talk to Fianna Fáil TDs, they tell you we're in a bit of bother here electorally, but we're not in as much bother as Fine Gael is.
Why is that?
I think the party has been a long time in power. I think Pat identified a kind of centre-right bias during Leo Varadkar's time that probably didn't resonate with the electorate. And you also have this phenomenon of many of its leading TDs, many of whom are nowhere near retirement age, just tiring of politics, or getting tired of the churn, getting tired of the constant abuse that they're facing on social media, and just saying, you know, the effort isn't worth it. You know, there are other possibilities, other lives out there. So I think there are 11, if not more, Fine Gael TDs who've decided to call it a day. That's a third of its complement of TDs. They've 33 TDs at the moment, so a third are gone before.
And we hear there might be more before the election's actually called.
I'm sure there will be more, and I'm sure Fianna Fáil will lose a few as well. The question that flows from that is, if Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are not doing particularly well, who benefits? And the answer to that until 6 months ago or 8 months ago would have been easy peasy, Sinn Féin. But that's not quite so clear anymore. Sinn Féin went right up in terms of popularity. They plateaued and are beginning to come down a little bit. And funnily enough, the particular portion of the political polity, or the politicians who are benefiting from that, are the independents. And the more independents they have, the more messy our political landscape is going to be after the next election.
Pat, one last question on Varadkar before we move on to what lies ahead, because you've been observing him in Brussels, observing him, as I said, his last ever EU summit. You have a very interesting and, I should say, amusing piece describing that in today's Irish Times.
Aye, you're too kind.
Yeah, well, that's probably the first compliment in years. So, you know, yeah. take it while you can. And just listen, you know, reading those quotes from him there, it just occurred to me, actually, one of the things about Leo Varadkar is he is a representative of a different generation, was a representative of a different new generation of politicians. And Ireland has changed. And it's actually not so unusual at all now for somebody in the midst of their career in early to middle age to say, feck this, I'm going to go off and I'm going to try something else. I'm sick of doing this particular thing. And we see that added to, of course, what Harry referred to, the kind of the toxicity and the pressures of modern politics as well. So my kind of opinion has changed in this bit over the last couple of days. It seems to me like an eminently rational and, in fact, quite a normal thing for a 45-year-old man who's been in a job like his for the last 10 years or more to do. Do you get a sense of that from him, that he's just done this thing that was only to be expected?
Oh, I entirely get that from him, but it's not a normal thing for a prime minister to do. He was an unusual prime minister, an unusual Taoiseach from the word go, and in preparation for yet another long, windy piece about it, which will be in tomorrow's paper, I was reading back over some of the coverage of in both our paper and elsewhere when he became Taoiseach in 2017. And there's this unmistakable sense in all the coverage at that point of this is something completely different. We've never seen anything like this before. And that was true not just because he was, you know, the youngest Taoiseach ever, that he was a gay man, that he was of mixed race heritage, son of an immigrant, but the fact that he was a different type of politician to all those, you know, stalwarts of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that had led the country before. And if that was true then, I think the manner of his leaving is equally different. And I think, you know, to delve in momentarily for, you know, to the reasons behind his leaving, he talked himself, I think, about, you know, political and personal reasons for his departure. And I think that's I think that is an honest and an accurate summary. And I think what those, I think it was the confluence of those two, of the political and the personal, over the last 12 months or so. Because I think, you know, when Leo Varadkar became Taoiseach again, obviously he was Taoiseach until middle of 2020, then he went to the Taoiseach's office, and he was due under the coalition agreement to become Taoiseach again at the end of 2022. And there was a sense in Fine Gael, I think, that this was going to, you know, mark the relaunch of, you know, the second phase of Leo Varadkar's you know, career as Taoiseach. And, you know, when he became Taoiseach first, it was a sense he was very different. He wasn't like other politicians. Well, of course, you know, if you've spent a couple of years in the Taoiseach's office, then it becomes apparent to voters that actually you are a politician, you know. And so I think that, you know, when he came back to the Taoiseach's office, what there needed to be was a sort of Leo 2.0. And that's what Fine Gael, I think, expected. And they expected that his ratings would improve and the party's ratings would improve. But that didn't happen. And I think one of the reasons it didn't happen was because of the personal factors, because of the personal changes in Leo Varadkar's life that had taken place over the previous 5 or 6 years. And amongst those, of course, you know, he when he came out as a gay man, he ended up kind of living a different sort of life than the one he had previously, I guess, when he was a minister. And he matured and he went on. He did obviously developed a relationship with his partner, Matt Barrett, with whom he now lives. And I think that Leo Varadkar came to the realization that there's more to life than politics, which of course most sensible and sane people, even people who are politicians,
is this podcast for you?
realize that a long time before their mid-40s, and they, you know, accommodate a life that, you know, or they construct a life that can accommodate both things. But I think that Leo Varadkar's outlook changed, and for somebody for whom politics was a totally consuming practice and passion since his early 20s, if not before, I think that changed his outlook on life. And I'm sure Harry will attest to this, that, you know, there's been countless conversations over the last year with people, you know, who have regular contact with Varadkar, who would privately admit that the sort of kind of relentless focus and engagement with politics 24/7 that he would previously have had, that he just wasn't. He wasn't doing that anymore. And that's not to say that he was neglecting his duties, or there were things that he didn't do or things that he did do that he shouldn't have done. I just think his outlook on life changed. And when you put together those personal factors with the political factors, which are very much the headwinds that are against Fine Gael at the moment that Harry has outlined, I think that it is the combination of those two factors that give you the decision that he announced this week.
Yeah, when I was speaking to him on Wednesday evening, and he essentially said, you know, 7 years of long days, late evenings, most weekends had taken its toll. And he said, you know, I just couldn't do that anymore. So the reason, I mean, one of the things that happened when the shock resignation occurred was that everybody's phone went bananas with text saying, what are the real reasons why Leo Varadkar has actually resigned? You know, as if there were a real story. But the story, in fact, was quite mundane. I think he just had tired of it. I think Pat is completely correct. The changed outlook in his life, the toll it had taken on him, in addition to the kind of slightly dismal prospects that Fine Gael faces in terms of a general election. But, I mean, no matter what you said to people, they still believe in that there is some kind of Uisce Fuí Chailf, a conspiracy theory. You know, there was a third Simon Harris on the grassy knoll. And that just isn't true. The reason for once is possibly quite mundane, you know.
Exactly as he told it to us on Wednesday.
Yes, and I can't see any other reason. There is no other reason. He wasn't pushed. There wasn't a plot. He actually gave you know, for a guy who's not known for his humour, he gave a very good quote at the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting on Wednesday. He said, you know, in advance of having a knife stuck in my back, I fell on my sword instead. And I think that probably sums up, you know, exactly the reasons why he left.
Right. Politics is a brutal profession. You only look back for so long. You look forward then. And we're going to do that after the break. We're going to talk about the next Taoiseach, Simon Harris.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. Harry, the whole thing was incredibly quick. It was really only 24 hours between Leo Varadkar's speech and it becoming completely clear that Simon Harris would be the next leader of Fine Gael and therefore the next Taoiseach. The last time this kind of rise to the top by acclamation occurred was with Brian Cowan in 2008. Oh, yeah. Didn't turn out too well. No. Would Fine Gael be better off having a competition?
They possibly would, but you said 24 hours. I'd say it was 24 minutes. Could even have been 24 seconds, Hugh. I met a special advisor on Wednesday who told me that Simon Harris already had 20 TDs lined up behind him and counting, and predicted quite correctly that the competition would be over before it even began. And any putative rival knew by mid-morning on Thursday that the game was lost. You know, that Simon Harris, by that stage, he had already accumulated half of the parliamentary party, and he had that kind of critical mass behind him, and there was no way that any of the others would catch up with him. The way the Fine Gael electoral chapel works is that most of the weighting goes to the parliamentary party, which is 54 strong. They get 65% of the overall vote in a leadership contest. The membership get 25% and councillors get 10%. But if you've got half or two-thirds of the parliamentary party behind you, you know,
in some ways it's a turbocharged version of what Leo Varadkar did with his leadership contest, wasn't it?
It is, but yeah. It happened much more quickly in relation to Simon Harris. And if Pascal Donoghue or Helen McEntee or others were considering mounting a bid, they were just outflanked from the moment Leo Varadkar stood outside government buildings.
Pat, the thing I find most interesting about this is not so much that Harris was ready to charge and carried out the process with such brutal effectiveness. It's that nobody else was at the races at all, whether caught by surprise or just low energy or whatever. There are a couple of big names who, if they had so chosen, you think would have been able to throw their hat into the ring with some effect. They were caught out so much by Harris that you kind of say their hearts weren't really in it, were they?
Yeah, perhaps there's an element of that. That certainly seems to have been the case with, say, Simon Coveney. I mean, I guess if we were having, you know, an idle conversation, not that any of our conversations on the podcast would be idle, Hugh, but if we were having, you know, a conversation last week, say, about who do you think the next leader of Fine Gael would be? Let's say Leo gets hit by a bus next week. You know, who would be the next leader of Fine Gael? I think we would probably have come, you know, down on maybe, you know, four names. We'd have talked about Simon Harris, certainly, maybe Helen McEntee, and from the older generation, then Simon Coveney and Pascal Donoghue. But as you say, none of the others had done the sort of work, I think, clearly, that Simon Harris, following maybe the example of Leo Varadkar, had done in advance of the 2017 leadership election. And, you know, it's very clear that, you know, I suspect that it was a combination of a very quick reaction and a realization that if you clock up a steady stream of endorsements on the first morning of the campaign, that sort of, I think Jennifer Bray described it as shock and awe in one of her pieces, that is likely to scare off the opposition. So while, you know, others may have been taking soundings, may have been just talking to their advisors, their families, whatever, about the possibility of mounting a bid, Simon Harris's bid was well underway and was racking up the endorsements. And of course, for every, you know, every promised vote you get, that's a vote that the others can't get. Their pool of support is diminishing steadily. And I think they realized that pretty quickly on on Thursday morning, and the whole thing turned into a fait accompli very quickly.
So, Harry, here are the things I know about Simon Harris. He's very young. He's the youngest Taoiseach ever. He's very ambitious. He's made no secret of that. He's extremely energetic, and we've seen that in the way, both in terms of his self-promotion in the various departments which he has run, and his engagement with the public, and as we now see with the party membership of Fine Gael as well. I have no idea what he stands for.
Well, this morning he was asked what he stood for, and if you ask Leo Varadkar, we've already discussed what Leo Varadkar would say. Simon Harris is definitely going to denote a change of direction. He talked about him standing for equality of opportunity and equality of treatment. So he sees himself as a person who will campaign for an equal society. Now, he will have to define the parameters of that and the characteristics of that as he goes forward. But that is his slogan for now.
How do you understand that? That sounds to me, possibly it can be seen as a centre-right position, because the opposition to that very often comes from people who say they want equality of outcome as opposed to equality of opportunity. So in a way, it's a kind of it's a coded centre-right position.
It could very well be, but we will have to wait until he delineates it and expands on it. But he's been a person who's been an equal access campaigner all his life as well. I mean, he has reminded us, as Marie O'Halloran noted in an excellent piece, a profile of him this week, that he began his political career as a person who was campaigning on behalf of those who have autism. He has a brother who had been diagnosed with autism, who wasn't able to access services, and that's how Simon Harris began what he described as being an accidental politician. He still describes himself as an accidental politician, but there is absolutely no accident in relation to Simon Harris being a politician. Politics just courses to every vein in his body. You talked about his energy. You talked about his, you know, I mean, if you were to look for a historical comparator, Hugh, the only person who fits the bill is a dancing priest in Father Ted. You know, this guy, once he gets up, he just doesn't stop. From early in the morning until late at night, he is always on point.
Okay, but accepting that, can I ask, and maybe I'll ask Pat this, what are his accomplishments in his political career so far?
Well, he's about to become Taoiseach. That's a fairly substantial accomplishment. Look, he was Minister for Health, and he survived that. Just about, though, There was a motion of no confidence against him. Now, no one Minister for Health, despite, you know, what our political discourse often claims, no one Minister for Health is responsible for the state of the health services. But public and political dissatisfaction with the state of the health services in 2019 was such that it led to a Dáil motion that many of the independents who routinely supported that minority government couldn't bring themselves to support. That happened at the end of 2019, and it was one of the triggers for the early general election in 2020, which turned out to be such a disaster for Fine Gael. He remained on as health minister in the early months of the pandemic, while negotiations proceeded on the formation of the present coalition, and is generally regarded to have, I think, handled those first few rather frightening and uncertain months very capably. He did that by, and I think showing his political instincts, he did that by essentially deferring to the doctors. He was making a virtue of the fact that he wasn't going to be making decisions. He came out and says, politicians aren't making decisions here. It's the doctors that are going to be making these decisions. And I think in hindsight, that was a smart move. It went on, you know, the longer the pandemic went on, I think the more it became clear that it was the job of the politicians to balance the advice of the doctors with the advice of other people and with the overall impact on society. But by that time, Simon Harris was gone. He was Minister for Further and Higher Education. The universities haven't liked him much as Minister for Further and Higher Education. The non-university sector has liked him an awful lot, and equality of access campaigners have liked him in that role as well. He has made significant strides, both in increasing the budget, but every minister or most ministers have managed to increase their budget in that period of time due to the increased resources available to the current government. But he has made significant strides in opening up access to apprenticeships and in elevating the status of apprenticeships within the broader further and higher education world. But, you know, So I think, you know, he has been a successful minister in that regard. He has avoided political problems. He was good at this most of the time in health as well, avoiding political problems. He has a deft political touch. He's a very good communicator. But avoiding political problems might get you to the Taoiseach's office, but it won't get you through being Taoiseach, because the problems all sooner or later come to land at the Taoiseach's desk. And the more successful Taoiseach are the ones who go towards problems, not away from them. And it'll be really interesting to see how he manages that change in the demands of the role. Because, of course, being Taoiseach is, you know, when you're minister, you're responsible for one area. When you're Taoiseach, you're responsible for the whole shooting.
So the first big challenge for him as Taoiseach, or the first big symbolic decision, more than symbolic, which he'll have to make, will actually be on the 9th of April, Harry, once he has received a seal of office from the President. There'll be a reshuffle. It could be a very minimal one, he's moving into the Taoiseach's office, so there's one vacancy there, he might just fill that. But I see a lot of chatter around over the last 24 hours from probably unwanted advice to him about what he should do. There's a steady as she goes kind of a camp, and there's a make some bold decisions sort of a camp too. What's your read on the state of play?
Jack Horgan-Jones is going through that and in some detail, talking about a kind of a de minimis situation where he makes the only one change that's necessary. He's been elevated from higher education to the role of Fionn Taoiseach, so there's a vacancy there, to slightly more convoluted ones. But he has to be very careful in terms of every chess moves he make, because each of them will have an implication for him.
Each one can make an enemy.
It can, yeah. So, I mean, Helen McEntee would be seen as his closest rival or nearest rival within cabinet. So there is some talk that he may move Helen McEntee from justice, perhaps to higher education. But he would have to consider that move very carefully, because she is, as I said, his closest rivalry. There's also been some chatter that perhaps Simon Coveney is vulnerable as well.
One of the reasons for that is, well, I suppose it's people reading tea leaves to some extent, who came out as quickly as possible to support his leadership yesterday. But there's also this issue of there are questions about a number of people, including Simon Coveney, about their intentions at the next election.
Yeah, whether they're going to actually stand after the next election.
And it's fair enough, isn't it, to ask one of your most senior cabinet ministers whether they're going to stand, and if they're not going to stand at this stage, to say, well, maybe you should.
I think that's the first question he will ask them. Are you going to stand in the next election? And if they're not standing in the next election, that will change the dynamic in relation to their ministerial prospects.
Does that include Pascal Donoghue?
It could very well include Pascal Donoghue. I mean, the clever thing for a TD to say is, I haven't made my mind up yet. And kick to touch, kick to row G. I wonder whether Simon Harris will buy that or not.
We actually, we actually asked Pascal Donoghue, that who's over, was presenting to the European Council this morning. And we asked him, he did a doorstep shortly afterwards. We asked him specifically about that. I said, of course, he wants to remain in cabinet. He wants to remain as head of the Eurogroup. Presumably, if he lost his cabinet position, that would be the end of him as president of the Eurogroup. He said he is standing in the next election and very much wants to serve. My guess is, you know, that it would be quite a move to get rid of your budget minister and president of the Eurogroup. My guess is there will be a come to Jesus conversation with Simon Coveney about whether he's going to stand or not. Bear in mind, of course, that, you know, Simon Harris managed Simon Coveney's campaign in the 2017 leadership election. So to remove him from cabinet, if he is going to stand at the next election, would be quite a move. But, you know, there's people queuing up looking for their chance. I think he will feel that he has to refresh his cabinet to some degree, and you know, two new faces would be twice as good as one.
Do you think, given Fine Gael's current situation, what do you think of the argument, Pat, that he needs to be bold?
I mean, I suppose every new Taoiseach wants to, you know, put his stamp on things and wants to be bold. Fine Gael is in political trouble at the moment. I think it has been for some time. The party's been in a sort of a slow motion crisis for some time. This is probably its one opportunity to get out of that before the next general election. So the stakes are really high, I think, for Simon Harris. A lot of the direction will come from him personally and from his office. He's got a couple of very difficult things to do. He's got to establish, he's got to make his cabinet choices. He's got to present a new face to the government. He's got to strike a balance between novelty, but also continuity as regards the coalition agreement. He's got two other party leaders that he has to quickly establish a relationship of trust with and a sort of a common modus operandi, because the, you know, if there's one thing that would surely presage disaster for all the coalition parties is if the coalition couldn't get on and messily fell apart. I think it's in the interests of all three parties to avoid that. But, you know, the changing of the Taoiseach necessarily injects a significant amount of uncertainty into the working relationships at the top of government. He's got to pick a staff. He's got to figure out all that stuff. So I think the cabinet choices are an important part of it, but they're only one
part.
Well,
the next part of it is almost immediately after that. We launch into an election campaign, Harry. We've got the Europeans and the locals. I don't think you'd find anybody to take money on a bet that Fine Gael are going to hold on to their five European Parliament seats. Everybody expects them to lose them.
But they're going to put huge focus on the European election. I think they know that they're going to lose seats in the local elections. But if you look at Fine Gael historically, it has used the European elections as something that has bolstered the party at times of crisis. If you go back to 2004, 2002, Fine Gael had a disastrous election. Enda Kenny came to the fore. They bucked the trend in 2004 when they won two seats in Munster with Sean Kelly and with Simon Coveney. They had Mairead McGuinness and Avril Doyle, their first kind of big celebrity candidate, Mairead McGuinness, rowing with each other like two ferrets in a bag.
It was very productive.
Very productive in the end, because both of them won a seat. Jim Higgins won in Connacht Ulster, and Gay Mitchell won in Dublin. That gave the party a much needed fillip when it was probably at its lowest ebb. And you can see that happening to a certain extent in 2019. It had an okay, relatively good local election, but the narrative was that the party was on a downward slide. But it did buck the trend in the European elections. It won five seats. And essentially, you know, it wheeled the scrum, as it were, in some respects. And you can see that strategy at play at the moment. The convention for Midlands North West is taking place on Sunday. And lo and behold, we have a kind of a literal example
of the runners and riders. I knew you were going to go there.
Jockeying for position with the introduction of Nina Carberry. And I understand that Fine Gael might be moving the process of nomination of the leader forward from Monday to Sunday, which will allow Simon Harris to be, you know, to have his coronation moment, you know, the Dauphin Prince, the leader in waiting at the convention on Sunday. But if is expected, that the two candidates there will be Maria Walsh, a former Rose of Tralee, and Nina Carberry, a well-known jockey, plus the winner of Dancing with the Stars, a bona fide celebrity.
There's going to be some really terrible jokes about this, you know, I can tell
absolutely.
Already.
But
we look forward to supplying them.
They will be hoping that they will win two seats out of five in that constituency. They have John Mullen, former head of Bord Gáis and an energy entrepreneur, very strong character in his own right, running along with Sean Kelly in South. So I think they're all in on the European elections and hoping that the European elections will give them an early fillip that will begin to kind of reverse the kind of trend we've seen with Fine Gael over the past, really, over the past 5 to 6 years.
What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, I think that's a plausible strategy, and European elections, very high profile, obviously, and successful European elections would enable Harris, I think, to, you know, to project political progress, to fend off the accusations of the inevitable losses in the local elections, betoken a party that's still in trouble. I think what he needs to do is to show progress, to show an upward curve. I wouldn't be surprised to see him get a bit of a bounce in the opinion polls over the coming months. But, you know, really, the big game is the general election. He has to make a decision on timing on that. It has to take place before this day next year, the 22nd of March. 2025 is the last possible day that the election can take place. There was an awful lot of speculation around, some of it pretty well informed, I think, that the most likely date was going to be in the autumn of this year. I think that will be one of the first things that Eamon Ryan, Micheál Martin and Simon Harris talk about. And, you know, both Greens and Fianna Fáil have been very clear. They want to go the distance. Fine Gael hasn't, certainly under Leo Varadkar, were disinclined to give them that assurance. I think that subject will be back on the table now, and Simon Harris will have to make a judgment, because it's his job constitutionally to pick when the election is, but he will have to make a judgment on whether he is, you know, if he does get a brief honeymoon as Taoiseach, whether he is better off trying to capitalise on that and going early. I guess the earliest is really probably this autumn, or whether he waits for the long haul, settles the issue now, says we're going to go the full term, judge us then. So I think that would be one of the.
But the odds of a 2024 election have lengthened considerably now.
Diminished, yeah. I think. Yes, yeah. I think so.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we leave it there. I'm sure we'll be discussing all these things over and over again over the next few podcasts. But as always, on our Friday wrap, we like to pick our favourite articles of the week from IrishTimes.com. Harry, what have you got?
Well, I've referred to it already. It's Marie O'Halloran's profile of Simon Harris, which has been published for the last 24 hours, which is excellent in terms of some of the anecdotes and some of the kind of the insights that she has had on Harris since his inception. It's great to see Marie back, by the way. She was off from work for a while, but she's back now and in full flow. So I've great pleasure in reading that article, and great pleasure in welcoming Marie back.
Absolutely, welcome back, Marie. Great to have her back, and no better week to have her back indeed. Pat, what's your article?
I was much taken by Mark Hennessy's run through of all the negative coverage, some of it overwhelmingly negative coverage that Leo Varadkar got from the British press, particularly the Tory press in Britain during the Brexit wars. And somebody sent me the editorial from yesterday's British edition, not the Irish edition, mark you, of the Sun newspaper, entitled "Leo the Loser," and which describes him as a self-satisfied pipsqueak, possessed of a toxic combination of preening vanity and blinkered ignorance.
That's one of Rupert Murdoch's Australian employees, is it?
So long, Leo. Could be Rupert Murdoch himself, indeed. Don't hurry back.
Very good. I'd like to finish the podcast on a high note by saying that my article is Patrick Frayne's critical analysis of Irish Wish, which was Netflix's St. Patrick's Day movie offering last weekend. I had the pleasure, mixed pleasure, of seeing it myself, whereby the great Lindsay Lohan comes to Ireland and has her life changed by making a wish granted by St. Bridget to have a fantasy life in Ireland, arrives at the Cliffs of Moher and says she feels as if she's in a James Joyce novel. So she obviously hasn't read any James Joyce novels, but it's full of wonderful moments.
Based on fact, is it?
It's full of wonderful moments of that. And Patrick, as always with these kind of things, does a wonderful job of taking it down and making us laugh. We will leave it there for today. Thanks very much to Harry and Pat. Thanks to our producer Declan Conlon and our engineer JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you after the weekend. Until then, thanks very much for listening.